Eastern Shore baseball reaches back decades with names like the Cambridge Canners and the Pocomoke City Salamanders. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. These days, if a fan wants to see a game, they'll show up at the Purdue Stadium in Salisbury to watch the Shorebirds. But there was a time when local baseball teams flourished up and down the peninsula. The NAB Research Center for Delmarva History and Culture is hosting an exhibit entitled Eastern Shore Pastime 100 Years of Baseball. In our studio this morning is Creston Long. He's director of the NAB Research Center. Welcome to the program.
Very good to be here.
So let me ask you this. What was the inspiration for putting together this exhibit?
Well, we had an opportunity a little over, about 2 years ago, to pursue a grant to the National Endowment for the Humanities that is called the Common Heritage Grant Program. And it takes, it provides some funding to for institutions like the NAB Center or historical societies, archives, to try to reach out into the community, surrounding community, to build up a collection that is connected to some element of community. So we had this knowledge that in the, well, really from the late 19th century through the last third of the 20th century, that baseball was a major part of community life during the summer season throughout Delmarva. And we knew that, but we also had very little in our own archives that reflected that history. So we started putting together this idea that maybe we could build an application around the idea of community baseball, and that we would build a digital archive of items that people from the community brought in for us to scan or take digital photographs of. And then we would build to an exhibit and a publication that tries to capture some of that past. So that was about 2 years ago when we were doing the grant application. And then in late 2018, we received word that we had indeed been accepted. And the program started last May. We had a panel discussion with two former Eastern Shore baseball players and two community historians who really have devoted a lot of time to collecting items, but also really trying to understand the history of baseball on Delmarva.
So this actually, the history reaches back late 1800s.
Yes.
As it were. Tell me a little bit about how this comes about. How is it developed?
Well, I mean, the earliest that the sort of evidence that we can find of baseball becoming a real presence on the Eastern Shore in small towns and starting to develop a following was in the years right after the Civil War. There was nothing quite like league play at that point. That would develop over the next few decades. But it's not a truly local phenomenon. This was becoming a national pastime. And really throughout much of the 20th century, it would remain the sport that many Americans would think of first when they thought of community sports, but also on the national level. So it starts developing in the late 19th century, and we start to see more formalized league play by that time. Now, the Eastern Shore Baseball Leagues, formerly named the Eastern Shore Baseball League, those come along in the sort of early middle decades of the 20th century. But in our the few items that we did have in our existing NAB Center archives were from that early period, the 1870s, 1890s. We had several photographs, really just a handful, of baseball teams from this area, from the Salisbury area. And they were small teams, but had fairly uniforms that they were wearing. You could see the equipment, and they really are fascinating pictures. There's also a picture that we had of a woman's baseball team in the Princes Anne area, and that was also a national pattern in the late 19th century as well.
What sense do you get about the difference between, on the one hand, obviously what we consider modern baseball today, and those early days?
Well, in those early times, it really, from what we've gathered in this project, the teams that small towns Woodfield really were homegrown operations. So communities, really, some as I think Parksley, Virginia, might be one of the smaller towns that we have some material on, fielded a team. We're talking about a population of several hundred people. But out of that community, they field a team, and then from the surrounding area would sometimes draw in for weekend games an attendance larger than the population of the town itself. So during the time in which there were, well, frankly, jobs available throughout these small towns on Delmarva, so a lot of them were related to the developing seafood industry of the late 19th century. Others were connected to canning of agricultural products. So long as little towns outside of the larger cities, not large, but places like Pocomoke and Prince's Anne and Salisbury, if we take those as sort of the population centers and go outside of them to the much smaller places, so long as there were jobs there that could sustain a population, we find that that's where the baseball teams were. And then over the course of the mid-20th century, as some of those operations began closing down, that's when we see the contraction of baseball into these larger population areas. So really, to get back to your question, it was at the core of community life during the summer. Often we'd find family members playing on the same team, sort of in some cases a family tradition, multiple generations having played in earlier years. And they had a true sense of community. And that is something that we don't really see now.
Now, when I've been researching this, Dorchester County, I guess, had its first major league player from the Eastern Shore, Homer Doc Smoot.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that and how the leagues or the players began to filter into the national level.
Right. Well, it's, you know, there was I'm not going to get the numbers right here, but there was an seemingly unusual number of Eastern Shore baseball players. Some who had grown up here, others who had moved here, but who went on to play in the major leagues. And there are several towns that really stand out. The one that I probably know best is Federalsburg. There were over a dozen players who played in the Federalsburg minor league teams that went on to play in the majors, and some of great, wide name recognition. Once league play began in the early 1920s, and then there were three renditions of the Eastern Shore Baseball League. During that time, that's when we found a, sort of an increasing number of players moving on to the shore to play on these teams. And that number of players that would then go on to the majors goes up from there. But again, we can find examples from the early 20th century. And it was a system that predates the farm team system that we have now and that's existed through a good portion of the 20th century to the current day. The farm system would, I think, basically grow out of that. But there were a number of standout players and several Hall of Famers that had their start here on the Eastern Shore that would then go on to the very highest honors of professional baseball.
So now they create this league. I guess it's the Salisbury Chamber of Commerce begins the formation of a Class D Eastern Shore League. What was the impetus for that at that point? Was there this commercial interest, or what were they thinking?
Well, if we look at those early, I mean, certainly there was a commercial opportunity there. And I don't think we have a precise answer on this, but if we look at the timing of the creation of that league in the very early 1920s, it dates to about the same time that the Major League Baseball was recovering from the great scandal of cheating during the World Series. And when there are those sorts of infringements of the rules, a league can take a can take a hit as far as interest and attendance. And I suspect that the timing of the growth of some of these other minor league teams might have had something to do with an effort to rejuvenate interest in baseball. It didn't collapse, obviously, but to formalize it a bit, to, again, try to take advantage of the commercial opportunity behind it. There are several things that come together during that first rendition of the Eastern Shore Baseball League.
Now, as a matter of fact, when I was looking at the league name or the team names, they're not traditional. I mentioned a moment ago, Cambridge Canners, Chrisfield Crabbers, Pocomo City Salamanders. I'm not sure where they come. Can you tell us a little bit about
that one?
I don't know.
But sometimes the so in some cases, they were names that were popular across the nation, right? We can find several, for instance, the Dodgers or the Cardinals. You know, there was the Salisbury Cardinals very early on. These were names that were taking root in other places. But as far as the ones that are unique, right? The Parksley Spuds.
Spuds, yes. You
know, we today, well, there is still some potato production down on the eastern shore of Virginia, but it was connected directly to that. One of my favorites is, again, a Federalsburg team, the Federalsburg Button Dusters. It's perhaps not widely known outside of Federalsburg, but there was a pretty large button-producing factory in Federalsburg. There were several others on the eastern shore. It was during the time where there was a lot of textile, in general, textile production here on Delmarva. And in connection with that were these button factories. So in Federalsburg, there was a button company, and the team took its name from that. So in some cases, it's connected directly to what the people are doing in their daily lives. In other cases, you know, I'd really have to dig more into the Salamanders. That's one of my favorites, but I don't have a good answer on that.
Of course, this is also occurring at a time of Jim Crow, which you have separate teams. Tell me a little bit about the African American teams.
Certainly. So they're from some of the earliest days of baseball organization in the last third of the 19th century. There was this question: Would African American baseball players be able to play on teams that also had white players? And there was a statement, position taken very early on, that no, indeed not. So from that point on, there developed really a parallel league for African American players at the upper levels of professional baseball, as well as in more in the local scene. So there were several of these African American baseball leagues throughout the 20th century. And for the ones that we studied the most, the community-based ones, in general, they would play other African American teams from other surrounding communities. But they also budgeted and saved to go play out of state, play on the other side of the bay, play up in southern New Jersey, Pennsylvania. And these were teams that enjoyed considerable support from their communities, enough support to fund travel, but also have uniforms and purchase equipment when it was necessary. So it carries on, really, this sort of parallel play through the 1960s. And that is when the Eastern Shore, the name at the time was Eastern Shore Negro League. It basically, once integration starts happening on a larger level, it essentially starts contracting and stops. Right. Now, some of the teams that had been part of that continued to play. And probably the best example, the most documented one that we have anyway, is the Oaksville Eagles. That is a community not that far outside of Prince's Anne. And that's a team that had formed decades earlier. It had had a number of seasons that were really quite extraordinary. And it was one of those teams that had a long set of family traditions of players from multiple generations. It continued as an all-African-American team playing just other teams in the area through even into the very early 1980s. But by that time, in general, by the early 1980s, late 70s, a lot of these community-based baseball teams had either stopped, or at this time we start to see, or not we start to see, we continue to see like company teams playing, teams that were connected to places of work. And those, in some cases, were, well, they still continue today, actually. So it's an interesting history. We can certainly see in this project that all of the general patterns of society and divisions within society are reflected in baseball itself. With that said, the gentleman that we interviewed for, who had played for years with the Oaksville Eagles and is sort of the historian of the team now, his name is Dr. Kirkland Hall. He has a long baseball career of himself and then a career in coaching and teaching. He pointed out that for their games, they would, in Oaksville, they would have crowds that were African-American and white. So there was a bit of a breakdown of that barrier there.
Now, as a matter of fact, you have a poster of William Julius Judy Johnson. Tell me a little bit about him. Why you particularly you
he was a major player in the first half of the 20th century. Out of Snow Hill, he would play primarily in the African-American League at the major league level. And he has been a subject of other exhibits fairly recently here on Delmarva. So there have been other places that have done quite a bit with his history. But he had started play in the second decade of the 20th century. So we're going back a ways here. And his career would continue, really working in baseball would continue. We can count his time working with the Hall of Fame up into the 1970s. He served as a member of he was a fellow of the National Baseball Hall of Fame. And once integration happened at the major league level, he played an important role in promoting the play of African-American players and promoting elevation into the Hall of Fame. So he died in 1989 in Wilmington, Delaware, but he had gotten his start. He was born in Snow Hill and was an excellent hitter, an excellent fielder. Generally, he was an athlete all around. He initially had some training as a boxer, as a very, very young person, but he really stood out as a baseball player and played in New Jersey, played in Philadelphia, and continued his connection to baseball really through the 1970s. Now, when he was nominated to become part of the Hall of Fame, that is when he resigned his position with the Hall of Fame so that could seem like it just seemed fitting for him to do that at the time. So he was the sixth African-American player that was admitted to the Hall of Fame.
Now, the league goes on for a while, but then in the 1930s, there's a hiatus. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, so there are, again, three renditions of the Eastern Shore Baseball League. There was the sort of the 20s version, 1921 through about 1928. And from the best we can tell, it really ended that time of it. We suspect because of economic issues. The Depression was not yet apparent on a national scale, but some of the early signs were there. And we don't have an answer that's a whole lot better than that. But people who have studied that league may have more to offer than I do. But it seems that is connected to that issue. It comes back in 1937, and then its second stint ends in 1942, and that appears to be directly connected to World War II. So those two are, at least we feel like, and the historians that we've talked to have a pretty good sense of why these started and why these ended when they did. Then the third try at the Eastern Shore Baseball League, it was really the shortest of them, and that was basically in the late 1940s, after the war, and then it would end in 1948. And, you know, don't have solid explanation for that, but someone that we've worked with connected to the Eastern Shore Baseball Hall of Fame Museum, and they've been great partners in this entire project. We can talk more about that later if you want. But he speculated that the development of television and the ability to watch games, which in 1948, that would have just been starting and would have been of limited access to a lot of people, but that it started then and gave another opportunity to experience baseball, that may have contributed to the end of the Eastern Shore Baseball League at that point. Now, league play goes on. There's the Central Shore League that develops not long after that, but the name, the Eastern Shore Baseball League, it passes from usage at that time.
Well, we couldn't get away with not talking about a scandal of our own. The Salisbury apparently was penalized in 1937 yes. for breaking some rules. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, there was a rule that had to do with who was allowed to play. And players of so much experience were supposed to be limited in how much play time they were actually supposed to have. And there was an apparently a violation of that the commissioner ruled, and he wanted really to begin enforcing rules at that point and to make a good example of that. And there was some legitimacy to it, although it is disputable. He made this ruling that Salisbury would have to forfeit essentially the first half of its season. And it was in the second half of the season that the Salisbury team committed to doing its absolute best and managed to maintain this winning streak that essentially won them the pennant in the league that year. And it's known as one of the greatest teams in minor league play and one of the greatest seasons for a team in minor league play because of that great comeback. So, it was an attempt to really assert the rules, to say these are important. We do have a league. There is going to be observation and enforcement of these rules. But the real story is, the fun part of it is that there was this great comeback, and that would go down in history. So we have that as part of our exhibit. Also, the Eastern Shore Baseball Hall of Fame, they commemorate that comeback in their museum as well.
So when we look at, for instance, as we appreciate this kind of history, we obviously have at the Shorebirds, mm-hmm. there is a little museum. Tell me a little bit about that. And how's that come about? What is the history, by the way, the Shorebirds and coming on? How does all that fit together?
Oh, okay. Well, so from the 60s onward, there was not minor league play at the level that we see with the Shorebirds. There were these other teams that were playing in leagues. Some of their players were advancing into the majors. But as far as a modern farm team, like there exists in Major League Baseball now, there was nothing like that for several decades. So it was in the early 1990s that effort seems to really have picked up support and become serious at that point. So it took several things. It took a location and some authority willing to take ownership of the process of building and sustaining a stadium. And it also took finding a team that would come to Delmarva, come to Wicomico County, and how would it be connected to the majors. So it's in the first few years of the 1990s that effort picks up. There was a donation of land from Purdue. There was a personal donation from Frank Purdue himself of a couple million dollars towards this effort. And then there was a team, which frankly I don't remember exactly where it had been before, or that part I'm a bit fuzzy on. But in its initial season, it was connected to the Montreal Expos. And that was just for a year. And then from that point on, it is affiliated even today with the Baltimore Orioles. So the Purdue Stadium and the surrounding land, the parking lots, that is part of the county. And the Eastern Shore Baseball Hall of Fame and the museum space that's there, it has been there since the earliest days of the stadium. And its mission is to, well, for one thing, support the work of the Hall of Fame, the Eastern Shore Baseball Hall of Fame. Every November, they have an induction of new members, and they have a vetting process that takes place before that. So there's that, but they also try to portray the history of Eastern Shore baseball. And really, it's a very good museum. They have quite a bit there. They have loaned a number of items to our exhibit that is up through mid-July. And we also, though, in meeting with them in planning all this, they also suspected that there were a number of items that people have in private collections that they would like to know about that that we could share. So part of this from the very start has been to, when we scan or take digital photographs of items, we put them into a digital archive, and also the Eastern Shore Baseball Hall of Fame Museum, they will also receive a hard drive that has those images. So when someone brings in an item for scanning, they sign an agreement that it's okay for us to scan the item, that they're okay with us archiving it, but also using it for things like this exhibit. So it's been a good partnership with that museum, and their collection is very impressive. They've got some jerseys that date back to the very early 20th century, mitts and bats and old photographs that that don't really exist anywhere else. So it is definitely worth visiting there. They're open when the Shorebirds are playing.
And I would encourage, by the way, people to stop by. They're like right off the entrance, I believe, as yes. I remember it. So tell me a little bit about the kind of items that you have on display. I was actually there the other day. Okay. So you have uniforms. You even have some what looks like old films of some yeah. of the old teams. Tell me a little bit about the kind of items that you decided that you wanted to have and why you wanted to have them.
Well, the items that we chose for the exhibit, we think do have some visual appeal. As I can talk about those films for just a second here. We have them scrolling on a digital monitor in the exhibit. And one of those, there are two basic clips on there. One dates to 1927, Salisbury, and it shows the beginning of a baseball game, sort of almost like a parade into the stadium. It was Gordy Field, which is over where Eastern Shore Drive is now, where the Salvation Army is today. That was the basic location of Gordy Park. And there is several minutes of footage of the baseball players, a minute or so of them actually playing the game, and it's in remarkably good shape. For 1927, we actually had that item in our archives. That was probably the one of the most interesting pieces. The other film there is mostly connected to the town of Federalsburg, some other footage that has survived from the mid-20th century. And those have visual appeal, and they're just fascinating to watch something that old. They're both just visual. There's no sound to them. There is a soundtrack that was added to them, but you don't hear the crowd or anything like that. The other items we chose, again, try to represent a good, inclusive history of baseball on the Eastern Shore, and have items, again, that have that. In museums, different sorts of items speak to different people. I mean, really, the jerseys tend to be, for me, they stand out a lot. They've the name of the team, the colors, and they're often jerseys that players actually wore. It that's a very personal connection that you can feel when you see an item like that. And the same with some of the mitts and bats. To me, again, I think the jerseys are what speak to me the most. That, along with a collection of photographs that really try to show either teams in action or sometimes posed for team shots, we're trying to capture a bit of geography in there, where these teams were spread around Delmarva in some cases, and we also have just sort of interesting items that are we'd expect to see as part of baseball games, either old programs. We don't have that many of those. Or something that came into us locally from Salisbury were these. They're not really baseball cards. They're much thinner, but they were pictures of players from the 1940s Salisbury baseball team. And we asked the donor where they came from, and they were inside of programs from the time. But they were unexpected. The other community historians have really studied this. They had not seen those before. And it appears that they were sponsored by local companies, these photographs, and then they would be inserted into programs. So if an item has some special, if they were unique, then we would try to include those as well. So there's always selection that goes on when putting together a museum. I do want to say we do have two exhibits, actually. There's one on the first floor of the Gurry Academic Commons, and that is almost exclusively photographs of teams from around Delmarva. Teams and some portraits, some smaller shots, but a lot of photographs on the first floor. It's up in our fourth floor Thompson Gallery, where we have the Friends and Rivals Eastern Shore Baseball exhibit. And that goes into a bit more history than you would read down on the first floor.
We've been speaking with Creston Long. He's director of the NAB Research Center, and we appreciate you taking the time to stop by and certainly encourage people to stop by and see the exhibit.
Well, thank you very much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Most of us don't think about who will take care of us when we get old. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. But there's a whole industry that does just that. In her novel, A Good Case, Cynthia Hammer writes about Sheila Price, who works for agencies that send her out as a caregiver for the elderly. It tells the story of two co-workers who become friends as they deal with the trials of low pay and uncertain working conditions. In the Dinkinsian tradition, Hammer highlights, through fiction, a major problem confronting today's society, and we have her in the studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi. Thank you for having me, Don.
So, first of all, you took care of the elderly. Tell me a little bit about that, because obviously that's the inspiration.
Okay, so years ago, I was a caregiver, and I still consider myself a caregiver, because at any time, if a senior or anyone that would need help, I would be more than willing to help them. I don't think you ever lose the sight of being a person. And so this is crazy. So I have to say there's some things going on that I cannot disclose at this time, my resources of writing all the characters. You know, I have a huge project underway that I really can't discuss exactly how I got the idea, but it's based on 99.9% true.
Okay.
Yes. So that's what I can say about that.
And why did you decide to use fiction in order to explore this issue?
Well, because I find that, you know, in the world we're living today, in the world that we live in today, people are so super sensitive. You don't know what you can say, what you can't say. You know, a lot of the times when I say something that's true, we used to deal in good and bad, and now it's better or worse. So you really can't say the truth without being challenged. Truth is truth. Truth used to just fall, and it's truth. So I said, you know what? I'll just write it as nonfiction. So there's no one says, oh, this was me, that's me. I don't know, because I knew the book would be very popular because no one's ever been able to write about caregiving. I believe it was a gift that God gave me, the ability to write this story, and it was for me to write it.
So before we get into the characters, mm-hmm. the kind of thing that you describe, as a matter of fact, I think I heard you describe it almost as a slave trade in terms of the workers that have to go forth and do these things, and or really a passion, I guess, for it.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I have friends in the industry, and they Okay, so you have the right to work for whomever you want to. You have the right to, say, for instance, if you work for Pepsi, I don't know if we can mention that on air, and you decide to start a lemonade stand. Do you owe Pepsi any money because you're selling beverages? So, and that's just a something I just thrown out there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you work as a caregiver and the client really, really likes you and they want you for their personal caregiver, you have to pay between $5,000 to $10,000 to buy that client to purchase another human being. So I call it a slave trade. And there's a lot more that goes into that, but they, you know, it's Los Angeles. They can do what they want. They pretty much do what they want, and it's wrong. And we have let legislation, and I don't want to get down that rabbit hole, but we've let a lot of things just go by until we till we meet it head on, and then we try to address it, and it's way too late. No one should ever set up a system where, and I understand you get some great caregivers in your company and you want to keep your company strong, then provide them something that keeps them with you. But a client and a caregiver has the right to move on. And a lot of times, caregiving used to be that the agency was only there to find the client a caregiver and send them on. They would receive their, like a deposit. They would receive a certain amount of money and search for the caregiver. That's how it originally started. But there's too much money to exchanging hands because the caregiver starts to make all the money. And the agency says, oh, no, 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 no. If I can keep you, slave, if I can keep you, I can take 70% of your pay and give you the rest.
So let's turn to the book and Sheila Price. Mm-hmm. Tell me then a little bit about her. I mean, is that you? I mean, I don't know if that's you or not, but
I don't know. I like calling the client. Well, it's a smart aleck African-American woman who has a lot of experience. You know, I love all races. I just wanted to write it where, you know, you go into people's homes and you're not, people treat you badly and you're not allowed to say anything. There's no such thing as disrespecting anyone. Period. Everyone should be kind. So Sheila Price has a price. That's why I called her Sheila Price. You know, I like to write where the reader can continue to read the book and something evolves. So putting a price, her last name is Price, mm-hmm. because she, you know what I'm saying. Because right. As the story unfolds, you understand what the dollar value is for a human being. And so it takes away what the true meaning of caregiver is. And I answered in a good case. So her character is she is a natural born caregiver, which a lot of people aren't. And however, she also is not afraid to take time out to engage with the client so she can be a vessel for that. When you have a 90 or 80 year old person who hasn't had a lot of experience with African Americans on purpose or not on purpose, to intercede in that gap, because we all are never too old to learn and to understand each other and to love each other. And when you have someone caring for you, eventually that heart softens and you'll see a person in a different light, especially when you need them. But she never uses the position of being needed as a means to harm. And a lot of people need to hear that and read that, because we have all kinds of people in the industry.
Oh, that's true. And we'll get to them in a moment.
Okay.
But she's also very religious. And there's a passage here that you write. It says, for many years now, God spoke softly to Sheila about the people who passed away in her care in her everyday life. She had a strong relationship with the Lord, receiving God as using her to comfort people before they passed over to the other side. How important is religion in her passion to do this kind of work?
So I do believe that religion plays a huge part, but it's not that one thing. We have to be clear, and they make it very clear in the business, that if you, no matter how religious, you don't want to be spooky kooky, like you don't want to be this religious nut, you know, that the lady, you know, needs to call 911. She's having a heart attack and you're going to pray. You call 911. But if a person doesn't know God and you know they're leaving the world, sometimes they'll ask you, can I talk to you about that God of yours? It's an opportunity. You don't knock them over the head. But when I was caregiving years ago, I would take time to meditate. and pray. And sometimes the client may see you praying and they may not know God and they'll leave you alone. But then when you have a serious conversation about life and their life and they ask you about your life, the Lord does come in. And so they're getting to know you. And I never back away from the opportunity, but it's not like I go around all day singing gospel
right.
or putting it on when they like the AM news that we put on the gospel. You're not supposed to infringe on who they are as people. It's their home. But for me, I do believe, because of my experience with God, that years ago I had seen, I would see homes before I actually arrived in them. So I would pray to God. Now, that's something personal, so I don't like to get too deep, but since you asked.
Right, no, go ahead.
It is that I believe that God placed me there for a reason. And so I always try to utilize, I always try to follow his lead because I don't know. So I just try to do the right thing and hope that I did the right thing. And with that said, I mean, why would you see something that hasn't happened and it, you get there and it's, oh my God, it's this person. I've seen this years ago in a dream. And so when you pray to God, the opportunity opens. Sometimes I've missed it, but a lot of times I was able to pray over a lot of people and then you could see the peace that comes to them. And there's many people who had God as well and would say, get me my cross or get me my Bible. And we'd read at night. You know, it just depends, you know.
And talking about, before we get to our friend, there's a character, Carmen, who seems to represent the worst of the of caregivers. I mean, she drinks a lot and she takes things. I mean, did you see that? When you were out there, and how would you describe her? I mean, she seems very just like floating through life there and picking up whatever she wants.
Well, you know, years ago when I was a kid, I was about 19 years old, and I had this huge cleaning service in Maryland. My mother was a housekeeper. I think I told you that years, you know, in a different interview. Anyway, so when I hired people, you know, if it was a 3 or 4 story home and you found the lady's, you know, diamond bracelet in the basement, you didn't find it because it's not yours because you found it downstairs. It should have been upstairs in her jewelry box, but it's not yours. And so you'd be surprised how many people don't know if you find somebody's dollar or $5 under the bed, you didn't find it. It's theirs. It's in their house. You'd be surprised who have that perception. So Carmen is the caregiver who thinks that when they arrive at your house, that it's hers. And she moves about as if it's hers, and it's very disrespectful. So, and there's many caregivers that are like that, you know, because the person is one, you're a stranger in their home, and they're a little afraid, and they're a little reluctant because it's all new to them. Some of them are used to it, but some don't have that voice. And some, you know, a lot of seniors are very, very polite, and they're not going to challenge you. You know, they want to get well. They're using all their strength for that. So a lot of times they're in a position to, they're vulnerable. And so the caregiver has to be an upright, respectable human being first. You don't even have to be a good caregiver. To be a good caregiver, you have to be an upright, respectable human being. Let's start with that. Not many.
Not a lot. Well, that's really uplifting. No.
there's a lot of us here. There's a lot of people that are great,
yeah.
But they have cases. You're going to always have a senior that's going to have that mediocre because it's a huge industry. You know, people are growing older and living longer.
Yeah. Now, her friend, Gladys Crenshaw, describe her for me. And I think you indicate she's from Trinidad, I guess it is.
Yeah, she is from Trinidad. And she is the no-holds-barred caregiver. She's perfection. But what I realized, she's used to working for perfection. When you work in Beverly Hills and, you know, anywhere, but Beverly Hills and other areas like the Hollywood Hills where there's the money just flows downhill. Well, not really. It flows into their pool. Doesn't flow downhill to the what do you call it? The migrants or whatever.
Right.
So they like things. They expect a caregiver to cut their strawberries into a flower. You know, they really want, you know, everything has to be perfect. And they expect it to be. And the agency, and you know, you have to be trained to set a table. You know, a lot of people don't really know how to do that. Not to the to the way that it's, you know, if you're serving a 4-course or an 8-course meal. So they expect that. And what they do, they try to hire or train someone who can provide that, because the money they make, $300 to $400 a day in a household with one caregiver, is what the agency makes. So with that said, Gladys is the caregiver who will they use to train the caregivers that, without paying this person. And so and she's good, and she takes it seriously, and she's every client's she's every client's dream. It's what every client would want. She's really, really good. There's those caregivers who come a dime a dozen, and I pinned her to be that, because they do exist. But they're always working because they are never without a case.
And along those lines, by the way, in terms of the kinds of things that they have to, I mean, you describe it, all kinds of things, whether it's obviously issues of incontinence, but also, you know, blood and that kind of thing. I mean, there's a whole range of things that would seem to be requiring some kind of expertise, I mean, that you're paying for.
Well, you know, okay, so when you're, if you're white, you usually are CNN or a nurse to do the incontinent. A lot of times the African-American or the Hispanic woman will do it without certification, because that is part of being a caregiver. But in order for some people to touch it, they think it requires more pay. So they'll go through the whole gamut of being a certified, which is fine. And then they'll try to move away from it because it's a dirty job, but it's part of the job. It's part of the heart. It's part of caring. We all, hopefully we won't all, but we'll pass through that, and you have to do a level of dignity. It takes dignity to help another human being to clean themselves up. There's no shame in it. It's not for everyone, but it's a form of love for mankind. So there's totally nothing wrong with it, but some people want the income, but they don't want to do all that is required. You could have a case where the person may not be able to get up out of their wheelchair. So you can't turn it down. People do. So you really shouldn't be in the business, because if you don't have the stomach for really caring for a senior, you shouldn't be in the business. That's my personal opinion. And so you do a lot. You know, I ran into a caregiver on the way here.
Okay.
Two of them, in fact. Can you believe that? And they were awesome. And I could tell they were awesome. They have a sense of caring about them. You can feel it. They exude care. It's in their spirit. And one of the ladies recognized me, and she asked me if I had a book and so forth. And she says, what about these young girls? She was like, talk about this today. What about the young girls who show up and they'll move a napkin around? And part of caregiving is actually cleaning the client's home. Well, it has to be offered in the service, but a senior does need a sterile environment. And a lot of people don't know how to clean and never clean, and they feel they don't need to do that. But that should be discussed with the agency, if what you're willing not to do. It shouldn't be taken out on the senior. Don't send someone there that you know won't keep the environment sterile, because the caregiver, a lot of times the agency represents that will be done for them. And the caregiver arrives and realizes she's got like 3 bathrooms and you have to clean it. Well, you really don't have to. You should hire a maid service. But agencies do offer that service with a separate type of caregiving assisting. They call it, they've chopped it up in so many different, job descriptions.
Job description.
Yes.
Okay.
So, but it what it's really about, it's about just making sure the senior has everything they need. No questions asked. No questions asked, but it's very difficult when you have a difficult one.
Well, as a matter of fact, so in the book, the people who are being cared for, they tend not to be so nice. I mean, there are a couple of instances where this is really bad. Tell me a little bit about that. I mean, on the one hand, we've been talking about the caregiver being all the things that they need to be. But then you get some of the people, particularly describe characters in the book, and it's like, whoa, maybe I don't want to be here.
Yes. Well, you know, I thought it was interesting because I have, like I said, I have so many friends in the business who have great cases. And some, for reason, for, through the years, I've had the worst. And I've had some good ones, but I've had the worst. And, you know, I've even worked, I'm going to say it on air, a crack house. Can I say that?
Okay, sure.
Okay, so the lady loved me, and I wish I could have stayed, but she had her grandson staying with her. It was a huge old house, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and he was just rummaging through the house, and he was in and out, in and out. The thing about it is, they know, a lot of times they know that the circumstances are grave in the house, but the senior needs the care badly. They don't tell you. They just want you there, and the agency just wants to get the check. Because a check is great. A check is a good amount. A lot of times it could be through their insurance. It could. There's so many components. It's really pulling a lever down on seniors' income, everything that they've worked for. Agencies have set it up just to pull it down and take it. That's a whole nother story. But I tried to implement that because I'm writing part. I have another book coming out.
Okay.
Yes. So that is the worst of the worst. The client was great. She knew that I knew, but the house was horrific. There was needles everywhere. There was blood everywhere. It was literally not in a good condition for her to be there. And so I pulled the son aside because that's, you know, this is my personality that you see in there. Right. I pulled him aside and I had a long conversation about, this is your mother. You know, she didn't need to come here, but he didn't want her at her house because of their issues. So you have all that, and the caregiver's caught in between. And some people can just show up and do the job. I said, you know what? I'll stay until you guys figure this out, but I cannot. I slept in my car. Yeah, it's 24-hour care. I stayed in my car. That's how bad it was. And so, and then also you have to look at the migrant worker that comes to work as a caregiver. I'm going to go there, who will sleep on the floor, who will sleep with no mattress. We have agencies that actually do that. Not here in Maryland, because Maryland, I think, is top-notch. The South is top-notch. Los Angeles is a huge issue. Mm. There's just so many people, and you can only keep track of so much. So I'm not saying that that was my experience anywhere on the East Coast, because I love the East Coast. You know, this is L.A. I'll right. just be straight with you. Yeah. It's L.A. So the difficulty comes also when you're dealing with wealth. You know, you have the lady, ding, ling, 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 rings the bell. You go lay down, ling, 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 and it's something. Could you change my channel? Ling, 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 ling. I don't want to watch this. Ling, 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 ling. Could you bring me some peaches? Ling, ling, ling. Give you Brits and cinnamon on my. Literally, it's all, and it's, you almost want to laugh, but you're like, God, this is not my life, is it? You know, it can't be. But it's funny because they're serious. They think you're there to wait on them hand and foot. And it's one thing, I don't mind you being spoiled. And some of these houses are beautiful, you know, so who wouldn't want to stay? But the client is just out of touch with, because the difference between their wealth and the caregiver.
Sure, it's dramatic.
Is so out of touch that they really don't get that that's a person and they don't care. They don't care. They don't care. And they do have their favorites, and the favorites, you know, will drive the Cadillac and they'll take them to get their nails done, and then the rest of you are servants. And it's okay. It's all okay. The agencies don't try to fix it. This is a client that brings in steady income to their new business, or a five clients to a small business is a lucrative business. And there's thousands of agencies in Los Angeles. I mean, thousands. So the problem is really, it's the problem comes down to what you're willing to do. If you're not willing to work for $10 an hour, work for $15. There's cases they'll pay you. If you're not willing to work for $15, there's cases that'll pay you $25 and $30. You don't have to work for an agency. You can work as private care, which means the client will hire you through a great reference, and you make the money that the agency makes. So it really comes down, the argument is, that it's a personal choice. You stay and answer the bell, or you find better, just like anything in life.
Mm-hmm. You, by the way, you have a chapter, I think, or a portion of the book called Venting is the New Black. And clearly this is going on between the two main characters. Tell me a little bit about that, because obviously you are sharing these experiences, as indeed probably everybody does when they have a common job or common experiences, right? But tell me a little bit about that. And how did you come with the chapter heading?
One of my favorite writers is Shakespeare. I don't know if people would compare my work to Shakespeare, but what I learned in when I was writing and growing up and loving to read, I love a book that gives you more than what you're getting, and then you read it again, like, oh, and you caught it because you're an avid reader. But the next person, next time, somebody will probably catch it, but you caught it. And The New Black.
Right.
Okay. You know, she's new in California. She's the new black. That's what I meant. And she's venting. So it's just that simple. Venting is a new black. But then also the narrative of the terminology, venting, the new, you know, anything that's new, the new black, or the new pink, the new red. So venting was, okay, so what I found out by interviewing caregivers through the years is that they all had a story. And they never said it.
Hmm.
You know, it's like we have so much in common, but no one will say it. And it's as if they thought they couldn't. But no. When I meet women or anyone, I like to hear when I say, well, what's going on? You have this look on your face. Talk to me. And then they're just like, and it's more than what I thought, because it's like an hour goes by. But I found out that there's something that they are torn with, which is caring for someone else and being taken advantage of their heart. It's a double-edged sword when you're doing the right thing and the right thing doesn't feel right because there's someone in the background taking advantage of it. You know, because caregivers really are people who really just care about people. That's it. You know, they're not suckers. They're not someone who has been bamboozled or manipulated. They really just care about people. But people, like anything in life, people will market on that. That's what they consider a weakness. Being kind is not a weakness unless someone sees it as one. And you really can't say anything. If you've worked for a specific job for years and that's all you know, unless you want to get certified and elevate yourself, you're really stuck in a position of not saying anything. Because if you say anything to an agency about anything, you are fired. Hmm. They will never tell you why you were fired. You already know why, but they will let you go. And then you get on that vicious cycle like Sheila Price because you couldn't keep her mouth shut.
Venting out loud.
Right. Right. Yes. So, and venting was good for the relationship. It bonded them, and it was good for their psyche, you know.
The other thing you talk about, there's at least one character or so that died in the care of the caregiver. Tell me a little bit about particularly that scene, but did you have that experience yourself or other people did?
Well, I've seen many people pass, many, through the years at a young age. I've never been afraid of I guess you could say a dead body is more scary to me in a scary movie than it is in person. Yeah. It's a little eerie, though, the first few times because you're in the house by yourself. It's a little eerie, and you kind of say, are they really dead? You know? But the first thing I do, I always say, thank God for allowing me to be here with them. And I would say a prayer. I go to a place of not fear. I go to a place of thank you, Lord, for thinking enough of me to allow this person to pass in my presence, not making it about me, just getting to the reality that this is a person who has lived a great life and now they're no longer here. And then what comes afterwards is very heavy because the family, but a lot of times the family is glad. They're overjoyed that the loved ones did not go alone, that someone was there, because there's a lot of guilt that they weren't. But a caregiver, as I say, is an extension of help. The family is too close to the flame. They cannot always be there. They have kids in college. They have homes. They have a life. Not that they don't love their parents. But, you know, the fact that they were responsible to find a great agency, a great one, or a great caregiver themselves and place them as an extension removes the guilt, and it should. Because they did what they were supposed to do. And a lot of times the parents don't want the kid. They want someone. They want to remain independent. They don't want their kids burdened. For whatever reason they discussed, it's okay. But what I found out is when a person passes, the family members left are overjoyed that their parents were not alone. They are overjoyed. And they're also relieved that it's over. I hate to say it like that, but it can be very stressful if you see someone suffering. But if someone just going naturally, then they knew it was coming also. So it's bittersweet. So I have experienced people dying on my watch.
Right.
And you know it's coming, but you always hope it's on the relief of the other caregiver. You know, because you're like, there's a procedure that has to be followed, and you don't want to ever be blamed, and nobody does, but there's a procedure that you have to follow, and you have to be very careful because, you know, a person's leaving the world. You know, you know the ambulance, the 911 is called, the police are, you know, come out, it has to be investigated, somebody has to sign off on everything. So you just want to make sure that you did everything that you possibly could. And it takes experience for that. You can't panic. You're responsible. It's kind of like you suit up.
Right. We've been talking with Cynthia Hammer. She's a author of a novel, A Good Case, about caregiving. You indicated, I guess, there might be something down the road, but we'll get to that in another time.
Okay. Well,
I appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.